Before we get into today's episode, I want to invite you on a unique spiritual journey this Advent season. It's called Journey to Bethlehem, and it's a free 9-day text message series designed to prepare your heart for Christmas. Starting on December the 17th, and each day leading up to Christmas, you'll receive a short reflective message pointing you to the hope, peace, joy, and love found in the coming of Christ. It's completely free and a great way to keep your focus on Jesus this season. Sign up today at premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now here's today's podcast.
Hello, good afternoon. Welcome along to the programme. I'm Justin Brierley, your host for Unbelievable this Saturday afternoon. It's about 2:30, and that means it's the time of the week when we usually get Christians and non-Christians together to do some kind of a debate, part of our Faith Explored range programming every Saturday. In fact, today, I've just got one Christian joining me, but I think we've got a good excuse for having a one-to-one conversation. I'll tell you about who's joining me on the programme in just a moment's time. Do stay tuned, though, to Premier this afternoon. If you can, we've got Brother Guy Consolmagno. You'll be hearing my conversation with him in the profile between 4 and 5 this afternoon. He's nicknamed the Pope's Astronomer. You'll be finding out about his life of faith, involvement in science, in the observatory that the Vatican runs in Rome. Really interesting chat about science and faith with him between 4 and 5 this afternoon. We're also, towards the end of today's programme, we're going to be hearing from Ian Morris, who is the producer of the God Question DVD series. You may remember that we had a couple of programmes about a month ago looking at some of the issues that raised. We had John Lennox versus Lawrence Krauss for our first one on God and the Cosmos. And then we had a debate between Keith Ward and Michael Roos, both philosophers, one Christian, one atheist, on God and consciousness. Well, we're going to be having, as it were, a producer response from Ian Morris later on in today's programme. So I hope you can stay tuned for that after we've heard from my special guest today. And who is that? I'm very excited to say that I'm joined by none other than N.T. Wright, probably one of the most influential Bible scholars in the world, also known as Tom Wright in his popular writings. He's sitting down with me today for the next hour to answer your questions. We're going to be talking about the Apostle Paul, which is the subject of his major new book, but also about heaven, hell, creation, Adam and Eve, Old Testament issues, what he thinks of the new Archbishop of Canterbury, St. Paul's view of women, and much more besides. I hope you enjoy today's programme.
You're unbelievable.
Tom, it's wonderful to have you back on the programme. Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you. It's good to be here again.
It's it seems a while ago now, but if you can cast your mind that far back to February, I think, earlier in the year, you joined me to talk about the new perspective justification with James White.
It was
a feisty debate.
Yes, indeed.
I think a lot of people... To be honest, I had trouble keeping up. I felt like two marathon swimmers in one lane and me doing the doggy paddle next to them sort of thing. But yes, what we've got today on the programme is a variety of listener questions that have come in advance of you joining me. But I really wanted to start by talking about your latest book, your monster book. It's here in front of us. And a large shoebox size type of thing, and obviously a lot heavier because it's a lot of work's gone into that. Yeah. Tell us about where it all started.
In a sense, it all started when I was a student, and with student friends was banging my head against Romans 7 and Romans 8, against Romans 9 to 11, against questions of justification, questions of how to live as a Christian, whether one can be, as it were, successful in Christian living, or whether we always stick in Romans 7, and particularly questions about predestination and so on, and we would always be going back to Romans 9. One of the things that happens when you start studying any subject, I guess, is that the questions that you come with get radically redefined as you get to know the material better. And though I still think those were important questions, what they did for me was get me into the whole world of who was Paul, what was he doing, what was it all about. So I did my doctorate on Paul. in the mid-70s, and I've always wanted, finally, to write the big book on Paul, which would try to pull together everything that I was thinking. The problem is, of course, over the last 40 years, a lot has changed. A lot has changed with me, a lot has changed with the big debates that are out there. When I was young, it was all led by German scholars like Bultmann and Käsemann and so on, who are great men in their own way, but their questions were very particular, very slanted, coming out of their culture. We now live in a very different world, and all sorts of new questions have come up. And that's one of the reasons the book is so big, because I didn't want to get to the point where really any one school of thought would look over my shoulder and say, well, you just haven't dealt with the things that are important to us. So I've tried to lay it out historically, culturally, and particularly, of course, theologically, and hold it all together in one coherent framework.
Paul and the Faithfulness of God. You had a recent launch in London. Tell us a little bit about that, how it went.
The launch was a very exciting event. Westminster Abbey kindly lent me the Jerusalem Chamber because, of course, I was a canon of Westminster 10 years ago, and so I know the place a bit. And that's a wonderful venue in central London. And we started with choral evensong with people there. We were all saying our prayers at evensong. And then we went in, and it was wonderful because there were lots of family, lots of friends old and new, people from around the country as well as around the world, and also not least my good friend, the Irish poet Michal O'Shiel, who has just himself published his collected poems from his last 40 years, as it were, and three of Michal's poems feature in my book. It's hard to explain, but anyone who looks at the book will see. The book has four parts, and in between each part and the next part, there is a poem by Michal, which, astonishingly, because he didn't know very much about the book when he gave them to me at my request, they actually function to hold the argument together in a totally different register. So I did my four talks on the four parts of the book, and Michal read his three. They're quite short poems, and it was a different sort of event entirely. It was I've never been at a book launch like that where I had the sort of double act. So I'm still quite buzzing with it. It was very exciting.
Well, how interesting. The book obviously distills and elaborates on as well what has been a lifetime's work, looking at the culture that Paul was writing into, the background and so on. In many ways, you must feel like you know that world, almost like the back of your hand, better than you know the world you live in today.
In some ways, yes. My students, when I was teaching in Oxford, used to tease me because if I said during the war, I didn't mean 1939 to 1945, I meant 66 to 70 AD, which was the Jewish-Roman War, which ended with the destruction of Jerusalem. And yes, I have spent a long time living in the first century, and I still love that world. I did classics at school, and I was just kind of fascinated by the whole world, everything from Julius Caesar to Vespasian to then in the background Plato and Aristotle and so on, and that's really still where so much of our culture comes from, and obviously it is where our Christian culture comes from, because Jesus was born under the reign of Augustus and then he died under the reign of Tiberius, and that really matters. That's not accidental, it's not incidental. Paul says in Galatians 4, when the time had fully come, God sent forth his Son, and there is a sort of strange sense in the background that somehow this entire background, philosophy, politics, religion, culture, was all, though a lot of it was very bad and very mistaken and misshapen, it was the moment that God chose to become incarnate and so on. And so studying that world helps us glimpse what it was that God was up to.
I might as well throw in one or two questions that have come in on Paul anyway. We're going to be introducing a number of questions that listeners have sent in advance of us being here today via Twitter, via Facebook and so on. I'll give all the ways that people can get in touch in those ways in a moment's time. Especially what you've been known for in previous books is this issue of justification. That was what you came on to debate last time you were on the show. And really presenting what for many people is a radical new idea or view of what Paul was actually saying when he meant when he talked about justification, when he talked about salvation, grace and so on. Here's one, for instance, from Josh Stuhlmiller. And this sort of takes us straight into it on the subject of justification. He says, how do you move from being on the wrong side of God to the right side of God? As Paul said, we were by nature children of wrath. We Christians, even we elect Christians, were by nature children of wrath. And now we're not under wrath anymore. Something happened. What was it? Do you want to maybe unpack what Josh is getting at there?
I understand. Part of the trouble is that there's a massively long Christian tradition in the Western world, not in the Eastern Christian churches by and large, but since the Middle Ages, of assuming that the real story that we're living in is an angry God, us in trouble, how we get out of that. Mm. And you can see this in medieval paintings. You can feel it in Luther and Calvin. You can see it in the Westminster Confession. You can see it in so many modern Christian movements. Part of the difficulty with that is that that isn't basically the story the Bible is telling. And my commitment in this respect under God is to Scripture and to the actual narrative of Scripture rather than the story that we have turned it into. Now, of course, wrath is important. Of course, the question of salvation is important. But the Bible is telling a bigger story, which is about God's creation of a good world and his call of humans to be the ones who look after that good world for him. The problem is that when humans mess up, then God's purposes for creation are stalled or thwarted. And so the story isn't just about me and how I can find God to be gracious rather than wrathful. The story is about God and about how his purposes can go forward. And since my sin and my failures are part of, as in that sense, God's problem, God wants to deal with that, not simply to restore the relationship, but in order that through the people with whom he's in a restored relationship, his purposes for the world can go forward. And it seems to me that's the biggest sea change that I would challenge today's Christians to get into their heads and their hearts. And actually, it shouldn't be difficult because the whole of the Bible is about it. Mm. The Gospels are about it. The Book of Revelation is about it. And so the danger is that we kind of abstract one element of the story, and it's as though you went to a Shakespeare play where you've got a plot within a plot within a plot, and as though all the way home you were only talking about one of the middle ones of that plot. Now, of course, it's important. Yeah. Mm, the play won't work without it, but you only understand what it means and how it works if you put it into the larger narrative. And just as a plug, in Chapter 7 of this new book, I set, it's called The Plot, the Plans, and the Storied Worldview, I set out how that works. So nothing of what your questioner is asking is lost. It's just that when we put it within the larger biblical framework, then we see all sorts of other resonances. Mm. And, of course, the main thing is that God is the loving, generous creator. And so out of the same love with which he made the world and will ultimately remake it into the new heavens and new earth, God sent Jesus as his act of utter generous love in order to die in our place and on our behalf to redeem us. Not in order that we could then just have a cozy relationship with God, but so that we could then, as he says, Paul says in Ephesians, be created for the good works which God prepared beforehand that we should walk in them. God wants us to be part of, not only part of his new world, but agents within that new world. That's the critical thing.
Ronald Dupre asks a question. Could Tom elaborate his differences, small question here, with reformed people on what Paul means when he talks about the law? I think this ties in. What are you talking about when you believe Paul mentions the law?
First thing to say is the word reformed covers all sorts of...
It does,
And I, looking from many points of view, if you come from a Lutheran point of view, if you come from many other points of view, N.T. Wright looks like a reformed theologian.
Of course.
And people tell me that, and that's actually how I perceive myself anyway. You know, John Calvin was and remains one of my heroes, even though, as with all my other heroes, I've got some
You've
serious
got differences
questions.
Of opinion.
Of course. And they would be the first to say, you know, go for it. In Paul's writing, I have become convinced over the years that when Paul uses the word law, Greek nomos, he is referring to the Jewish law. It is not a generalized moral principle that hangs over all humankind. It is the law which God gave to Moses, the law which then says certain things to the people of Israel. And when Paul uses that word, sometimes he's talking very specifically about the commandments and the commandments which people break. Sometimes he's talking about the whole Pentateuch, and the Jews regularly refer to the law, the prophets, and the writings, where the law is the first five books, Genesis to Deuteronomy. So that when, for instance, in Romans 9 and 10, Paul tells the story of Israel. It's the story from Genesis to Deuteronomy, because many Jews in Paul's day didn't just see Genesis to Deuteronomy as the backstory. The end of Deuteronomy is prophecy, and so they saw Genesis to Deuteronomy as the whole story, and they were still living in the last chapters of Deuteronomy. So when Paul tells the story from Abraham to the Messiah, he then says, so here we are in Deuteronomy 30, Romans 10 verses 6 and following. Until we come to grips with the narrative dimension of the law, that it isn't just a set of moral commandments in the abstract, but it's the story of Israel as set out by God through Moses, unless we do that, we simply won't understand what he's talking about. It is complex. It's bound to be complex. In the book, again, as part of the narrative, I play with the idea from Shakespeare's Midsummer Night's Dream, where one of the characters in the Midsummer Night's Dream is the moon. The moon appears in the very first speech, where it's a good thing. When the new moon comes, then we're going to have this great wedding. But then very quickly the moon becomes a dangerous and rather sinister thing, and it goes on all the way through. It plays different roles according to which level of the story you're in. In the same way, when you understand how the story works, the law, the good God-given law, plays a different role at each level of the story. Unless we're prepared to say that, we fall down into the thing of, is the law a good thing or is the law a bad thing? And that's just trivial. Sadly, that's where a lot of theology has got stuck.
Yes, I suppose it is that I guess, not seeing these things necessarily as black and white, but that authors, Paul especially, used words, phrases in different contexts in different ways.
Well, of course, we all do. But particularly a word like that, because it's already got so many resonances in the Jewish world of Paul's day. But as I say, when you transplant that into other cultures which are not resonating with what it meant to be a first century Jew and to share those hopes and those aspirations, then the language gets flattened down, and worse, it starts to mean other things. And that's so with justification, it's so with a lot of, it's even so with Christology, with the words we use about Jesus. You know, the word Christos, which we regularly just leave as Christ, we assume that's a proper name. It isn't. For Paul, it means Messiah, and carries all the meaning of Messiah, which then has to be teased out. And if you miss that out, there's chunks of Paul you just won't get.
Just finally on Paul, what sometimes is levelled at Paul is that he was somehow introducing a new form of Christianity. Jesus started one thing, Paul began another thing. What's your response to those who say that you know?
That's a typical 18th century perspective, which has turned Christianity into a religion and has made Jesus the teacher of this religion and then Paul the second teacher of this religion. That is a classic 18th century move. It would be very interesting to tease out why that was important in European culture, to try to squeeze Christianity into a box that it didn't really fit. It's not like that. It's much more as though, and I've often used these illustrations, it's as though Jesus is the one who has composed this amazing symphony, and Paul is the one who's teaching the orchestra to play it. Now, you say, but Paul, you're not loyal because you're not composing this symphony. He says, no, the symphony's already been composed. If I was to compose another one, that would be disloyal. It's not my job to do again what Jesus did. I've got to make the world play it. So Jesus was doing the unique one-off thing which was launching the project of God's kingdom on earth as in heaven. And Paul says, right, that has happened. Now it is my job to tell the world the good news that God is now in charge in and through his son Jesus and by his death and resurrection. And Paul knows that when he tells people that, strange things happen, like they get converted and people get healed and communities get changed and new communities spring up. And so Paul is not accomplishing the thing which Jesus has accomplished. He is implementing it. He's putting it to work in the world. And it seems to me that is utterly, utterly compatible.
I'd like to talk more about that whole issue of the kingdom and the way Paul represents that and so on, which again has been a core part of what you've done in your work over the years. You're listening to Unbelievable, special one-on-one interview today with Tom Wright. He's a well-known Bible scholar around the world, professor of New Testament at St Andrew's University in Scotland, popular author and speaker, former Bishop of Durham, of course. And, well, if you'd like to respond to anything you're hearing on the programme today yourself, you're more than welcome to get in touch. You can do that via email, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can also tweet me at UnbelievableJB if you want to do that. A lot of people who I'm reading out these questions from have from the tweets. Also, of course, from Facebook, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB. And you can find all the links and this program and, of course, links to Tom's new book on Paul from the website. As ever, that's premier.org.uk/unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Let's continue talking, Tom. I'll try and sort of whisk through a few of the questions that we've had in. Talking about the kingdom, Bengt Odman asks, if heaven is not the end of the world, what is hell not? Now, that's a sort of way of putting it, isn't it?
Part of our difficulty here, again, is that, and again, this is a Western medieval thing, that heaven and hell came to be thought of as sort of equal and opposite destinations. And you only have to look at Michelangelo's great Sistine Chapel to see that's how they thought of it. When you come with that picture in your mind and then read the New Testament, there are one or two places where you find, for instance, the parable of the sheep and the goats. It looks as though, okay, these ones are on the right, these ones are on the left. But by and large, this is not the way that Paul and the others talk about it. And in the new creation, in Revelation 21 and 22, something has happened which has meant that evil has been banished from the world for good. And it's not that here is the good bit of the world over here, and then there's a sort of concentration camp where people are being tortured over on the other side. Somehow, the point of the judgment scenes in Revelation is not to give the idea of yeah, that's how it's going to be forever and ever and ever there. It's a way of saying that evil is always a deprivation of good. Evil is what happens when the good purposes of God the Creator get thwarted and something else happens instead. So when God's good purposes are finally accomplished, then that will be the reality. Now, this means that I have an uneasy place in the study in modern theology, because I'm not a universalist, but I'm not exactly a conditionalist either. I mean, there isn't a box in the usual way of lining these questions up into which I readily fit, because it does seem to me, and I've expounded this in various places, that the language in Jesus and Paul and Revelation and so on about final judgment is richly metaphorical. It's very picture language, and we should beware of picking it up and assuming that it is stating absolute concepts in a 17th century or a 19th century sense.
But I don't know whether Callum then sort of, you've already answered his question here, perhaps, but he says he wanted to ask you, what do you think of inclusivism, the idea that people do not need to consciously affirm Christianity in this life to eventually be saved?
It depends what you mean by consciously affirm. The danger with putting it like that, of course, is that you make faith a work, that faith is something which I do to sort of raise a flag and say, hey, God, I'm on your side. And God says, oh, good, right, you can come in then. And there's a mystery there, because in the New Testament, faith is always the gift of God. This marks me out again as a Reformed theologian. Having said that, we have to be very careful. I was with somebody the other day who is the father of a child who has serious, serious learning difficulties and mental problems and deep personality disorders. And he, as a father, has wrestled with the question of, is this child of mine actually capable of responding to the love of God? And he has come up with the answer, yes, she certainly is. And I know from my time as Bishop of Durham, one of the most moving parishes I used to go to in my diocese was one where they had several young people who had Down syndrome. And these Down syndrome people, many of them young, were fully part of that congregation. Now, when you look at those people and see their eyes shining and their hands outstretched to receive communion, you say, well, I don't know what it's like being inside their skull, but I am absolutely sure that God is thrilled that they're here and that God loves them. So the question of what counts as articulated faith, we have to be really careful about that. Now, and I say that without any desire, as it were, to go soft on it, to make it easy to say, oh, well, so-and-so's a nice sort of person, they're probably all right. Absolutely not. Paul would say, no, you know, they need to come into the family as believing, belonging, behaving members. And if not, then watch out, because Paul is full of warnings about what happens if people really don't get it. So I want to say faith matters enormously, but the thing that faith actually is gets more mysterious the more, as a pastor, you get to know actual human beings.
I've got so many questions here, but one that sort of at least a little bit ties into this, though not entirely. While we're on the subject of hell, John Gombis asks, does Tom believe in an actual Satan, or is it just an anthropomorphic creation?
Do you know, I have to say before I answer this, I am depressed at the thought that faced with the range of topics which Paul has, people want to talk about hell and Satan. Come on, get real, guys. This man was writing about the love of God, about the righteousness of God, about the justice of God, about the new creation, etc., etc. Why are we, as Western Christians in the early 21st century, fixated on hell and Satan? Yes, they're important. Okay, I'll talk about them. Mm. These are not central topics. Mm. And if you find you're worried about them and fixated about them, go and get a life, a biblical life. You know, seriously, this is really important. There's a sort of a paranoia there.
Yeah.
No, I think when Paul talks about the Satan, obviously this is a Hebrew word which means the accuser, and in the Old Testament, the Satan is the director of public prosecutions in God's court, God's heavenly court. Now, how much they believed in the Old Testament that this was an actual angel or demon or whatever, I think they probably did. That's fine. I think there is a being of some sort who is the proper object of that language. The problem is we don't have good language for that. We tend to say it's either personal or impersonal, and that's why I say, no, it's not either of those. I've called it subpersonal. Mm. That's why in my works I try to refer to the Satan as it rather than he, because I think he just gives him a bit too much dignity. Mm. I think this is a creature. It's a creature of God who's gone rogue, who's made it his job to point the finger, to accuse people, even accusing Jesus. You know, Satan entered into Judas. That means Judas was taken over and became the accuser, the one who would hand Jesus over. So we need to be careful about our language. And yes, I think we're talking about, if you want, a real figure, but the language we use for this real figure is contested and difficult, and we should beware, just as we should be aware of being fixated about it.
Fascinating stuff. Well, we're going to be asking you to spell out your views on creation, Adam and Eve next, Tom. So come back for that in a moment's time as we continue Unbelievable. My special guest today, N.T. Wright.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to Unbelievable. It's Saturday afternoon, and normally on this show we get two points of view debated. Well, today, just for a one-off really, we're having a Q&A with one person, N.T. Wright, a well-known around the world, one of the most influential Bible scholars probably in the world. And as you know, he joined me, if you're a regular listener to Unbelievable, back at the start of the year to do a debate on justification with James White. Well, he's back again, this time answering a range of questions, taking some of your questions that have come in via Twitter and Facebook in the past week or so. If you do want to join in the conversation via Twitter and Facebook, then do go to the website premier.org.uk/unbelievable to find out how to get onto those and all the rest of it. And I look forward to hearing your views as well. I'll give you the ways to get in touch via email a little bit later on in the program. Another issue that often comes up, I think has relevance to certainly to what Paul has to say, is the issue of creation and fall and so on. And a number of people seem to want to ask questions on that as well.
Sure.
So before we get to the end of the first part of the programme, just quickly on this. John Bennett asks, I'd be interested to hear his views on Genesis, evolution, the fall. And why does Christianity for him still make sense? But in a longer sort of way of putting that, Lars asks, I'm a former Seventh-day Adventist minister and great admirer of your work. It's influenced my theology a great deal. Here's my question. Personally, I've come to find the evidence for the theory of evolution quite persuasive, but I'm struggling to get it to fit with my theological understanding, not just in terms of the biblical storyline, but also the character of God. Why would a God whose loving character is revealed in Jesus create us through a process of suffering and death, which evolution evidently is? I recall from your book, Surprised by Hope, that you're opposed to a Darwinistic idea of human process. But are you as critical of the theory of our origins? I see you've made small contributions to the BioLogos Foundation, and wondering what to make of it all.
Okay. The main contribution I think I made to the BioLogos Foundation is that I, together with Francis Collins, wrote a song, Genesis.
Yes, I've seen that on YouTube.
to the tune of Yesterday.
I was tempted to ask you to bring your guitar in, but
no, I'm flying at the moment. I couldn't carry a guitar as well. I mean, obviously these are good and big and important questions, and I am a fan of the BioLogos Foundation, and Francis Collins Collins, who sort of set it up in the first place, is a very great man and a fine, fine Christian and scientist. He gets flack from both sides in America, and that's too bad. That's again, a bit of cultural paranoia, which is worse in America than it is here. Yeah, I think the critical thing is this, and this is just a little bit complicated, but we just have to hold on to our chairs and make sure we can get through it. The philosophical climate of the last 200 or 300 years in the Western world has been basically Epicurean, and the Epicureans believed that if the gods existed, they were a long way away, and so that the world is not a place where any gods or God intervene. The world does its own thing, moves on its own terms, and that when we die, we just disappear into nothingness, and that's the way it is. And the original Epicureans in the ancient world said this in order to avoid the idea of an angry God who is going to come and get you, that no, it's not like that. They're a long way away. They don't care. And so the world is just rumbling along. So actually, the early evolutionists were the ancient Epicureans. If you look at Lucretius from the first century BC, he is basically a pre-Darwin Darwinian. Now, the problem is that the facts, clearly, and I want to talk about facts, are on the side of saying that the way we got to be as we are was a long, slow process. Now, if you're studying that long, slow process, but you've already got an Epicurean worldview, you will think of that long, slow process as something from which God is utterly absent. And so they took these facts and, this actually proves Epicureanism or deism, that there's an absent God. And this fitted very well with the ideology of the 19th century, not least politically. We've banished God upstairs, and now we will get on and run the world downstairs, so that modern Western democracy is actually the political correlate of Darwinian evolution, that we just, our society rumbles along, does its own thing, and we don't want God on board. That's why in America they have the church-state split, and it's why many people in this country would wish that we could too. They don't want the rumour of God on board, in case it cramps their style for doing our own thing, morally as well as politically. Now, over against that, it seems to me the Christian has to hang on to a biblical vision, which is of a God who is both other than the world and strangely involved in the world. And the strange involvement of God in the world is precisely a loving involvement, which means that it isn't simply a matter of God making a machine. It's a matter of God's generosity, of God letting be, let there be light, let there be whales, let there be trees, humans, whatever. And when God lets there be, there is a sense of God saying, get on with it, guys. I want you to be autonomous in that sense. Not that you're outside my world, not that you're outside my love, but that I want you to be real creatures and not just puppets. And so all the sorts of questions we have arise out of that rather complicated but very important view of creation. The thing to hold on to is the generous love of God. That's where it all comes
back. I suppose,
back to.
And that's what Lars is questioning in a sense, is that this process that science has elucidated evolution is a one that operates on the mechanism of death, you know, to drive it forward.
But I think it's a curious thing. In the animal world, death is as well known as it is in the human world. And animals have ways of coping when one of their tribe dies. You know, unless you have roadkill, you basically don't see dead animals around. They know that there's a time to go and lie down. They know, and I think elephants have graveyards and so on. And it's very interesting that there's a sense that the animal world, like the world of trees and plants, there is an autumn, there is a winter, there is a spring. And there's a sense that, yes, this is what we do, this is how it is. What happens with Genesis 3, and I do think there is a historical correlate. Okay, Genesis 1, 2, and 3 is wonderful picture language, but I do think there was a primal pair in a world of emerging hominids. That's the way I
read. So you do believe in that sense a kind of Adam and Eve prototype?
Sure, but it seems to me that just as God called Abraham and Sarah out of a welter of wandering nations and said, I've got a special purpose for you, the way that I see it is that God called one pair of hominids and said, okay, this place is a bit chaotic. You and I together, we're going to have a project. We're going to plant this garden and we're going to go out from here, and this is how it's going to be. So when Cain goes off, he founds a city. And excuse me, who else is in the city?
Where are the other people coming from?
And ancient Jewish readers knew this perfectly well. They knew that this was not the first ever humans or anything like them. But it's very interesting that Cain's instinct is to plant, to found a city, because that's deep in our DNA, is to found community, that God wants this primal pair to look after the garden and make it a place of community. The problem right from the beginning is that we split apart the city and the garden. And so it ends with the Tower of Babel in Genesis 11, which is Babylon. And so to repair that, God calls a nomad, namely Abraham. Do you see how it,
works? Yeah,
and all of this comes together. And my frustration, Justin, is that so many Christians who are good Bible Christians have never heard what I've just said. And yet, excuse me, it's on the face of the text. I didn't make this up.
Let's continue some of these questions. On a general note, since you were in, I think Archbishop Welby has been installed. Your successor at Durham, of course, for a short period at least, before he was called into his current post. What are you making so far of his appointment?
Well, one of the delightful things about my present world is that I deliberately cut my links with, you know, doing a job like being Bishop of Durham for 7 years, as I did, is completely all-embracing. It's hard to think and feel anything but that day and night. And so I knew when I moved to Scotland that I just had to sort of draw a line there. Otherwise, I would have gone on mentally doing the job. So I don't any longer take English church newspapers and magazines.
Because, really? You've cut yourself off.
I cancelled my subscriptions to various newspapers and journals because I was finding I was still buzzing with it and wanting to write articles and so on. I'm being a New Testament scholar now. So, I haven't seen very much of Archbishop Justin, but I've met him two or three times, and he's a star. I mean, he has got this really sharp mind, and he can jump into situations and see very quickly to the heart of them and then tell it like it is. And to watch him from time to time on the news in that Banking Standards Committee, that, where he was nailing George Osborne and people, I think, good, that is what an Archbishop of Canterbury ought to be able to do. And he is gloriously different from Rowan Williams. Rowan is one of my dearest friends, got wonderful skills, wonderful gifts, but obviously we needed a change, and that's great. We've got a change, and he's very good. He's God's man for God's moment, and my wife and I rather shudder to think if we hadn't made the decision to go to St Andrews, which meant that he went to Durham, he probably wouldn't be there.
Yeah, absolutely. Did it ever cross your mind that it might be a role that you could ever be suited to?
No, I know my skills now. I'm nearly 65, so I'm too old for it anyway, but I now know what I'm good at and what I'm not good at, and I know that that job requires quite a large skill set, most of which I either don't have or only have in small measure. And
what sort of skills are you thinking
of? Well, I mean, there's all sorts of sheer patience with all kinds of organisational bits and pieces. And I used to get so frustrated as Bishop of Durham because, you know, we have Lambeth Palace, we have the Church Commissioners, we have Church House, we have General Synod, we have Bishops in Parliament, etc., etc., each one of which thinks it runs the Church of England. In fact, none of them do. It bumbles along in this way and that. And my hope is that Justin, who understands how organisations work and thinks strategically, that he may actually be able to bring some clarity, because we just can't afford that kind of bumbling along this way and that.
Well, obviously, we'll you can forget about that all now. It's some way in the past. But let's return to the subjects at hand. Again, got listener questions here. We'll try and tie some of these in. They're from all kinds of angles, but to the book as well. And just a reminder, if you're listening, you've perhaps just tuned in. Tom's major new book is Paul and the Faithfulness of God, published in the UK by SBCK. N.T. Wright is actually the name you go under with the more academic titles, isn't it?
That's right.
And your popular works are Tom Wright. But Tom, or NT, is with me in the studio today. And if you want to give your thoughts on anything that he says in today's programme, as ever, do email unbelievable@premier.org.uk. I wonder if there may be a tie-in with this question, but a non-Christian who listens to the show writes in, it's asked to stay anonymous, Tom. But he wants to ask you this. I'd like to ask Tom how it is that I can have a good level of confidence that the divine decrees and moral imperatives found in the Bible are anything more than mere moral norms of an ancient culture, given the contradictions, ancient attitudes and commands that make us shudder these days, and how their own beliefs developed over time, maybe labelled progressive revelation. Isn't it more likely that the ancients interpreted their own moral norms as the good and sought to pass these on, which over time evolved into a sort of God-has-spoken belief system? And so you go on to the person goes on to say, contrary to the popular opinion that God has handed down some monolithic faith that all Israelites accepted, Israel's understanding of God changed over time, even taking on ideas and practices of other faiths, which surprised me to learn. Weren't the Hebrews and Jews and gospel writers just fumbling around this crazy life, trying to understand it like we are, desperately seeking certainty in a frightening and uncertain world? And he ends on this note. However, how can I ever re-experience the confidence in the Bible and Christianity that my ignorant days of fundamentalism gave me? I wish I could.
That's that's very critical at the end, and I understand where this person is coming from, because I know a lot of people, actually more in America than I know here in this country, who grew up in a very tight either fundamentalist Protestant or indeed fundamentalist Catholic world, where here are the 19 certainties which we teach and stick with these and you'll be all right, and then people suddenly discover that there's a crack in the glass somewhere and a sort of sense of, oh my goodness, it was wrong about that, maybe it's wrong about everything. And people often do lose their faith, sadly, when they've been boxed in like that and perhaps need the space. These are huge questions, and there's no way that in a short answer I can even get into them, let alone do justice to them. But for me, the center of everything is Jesus. And if it wasn't for Jesus and for all that we know about Jesus, including his launching of God's kingdom, his death, and then specifically his resurrection, if it wasn't for that, then I would say, yes, Judaism, ancient Israelite religion, these are among other claims which are out there, etc., etc. But when you put Jesus in the middle of the picture, you say, well, Jesus took that entire Jewish and ancient Israelite tradition and seems to have brought it to a crunch, to a head, to a climax. And when we look at him, we see retrospectively that actually it made more sense even than the ancient Israelites themselves may have realized. And when you read the stories, I mean, the stories in the Old Testament, in the Book of Numbers or whatever, are not stories about a people who say, God has spoken to us, we know what's true, here we are. They're wandering this way and that, they're blundering about, some of them want to go back to Egypt, they get it wrong, they worship idols, they do this, they do that. And so, of course, the faith which was being articulated by their leaders, by Moses and so on, and then by prophets later on, was contested, was very dubious, and they wander this way and that. But the big story, the story of the Creator God calling a specific people for a specific task, which would involve them in all sorts of strange adventures, that story rings true when and only when we look at Jesus. I mean, of course, Jews today cling on to that story and make sense of their lives through it. But that is still, for them, a matter of saying, this is what we believe, but it's hard to prove, etc. For the Christian, that which is vague and fluffy around the edges comes into sharp focus with Jesus. And as a historian, I want to say the evidence for Jesus, his death and resurrection, is remarkably good. We can actually nail our colours to that mast.
Speaking of that, some people have wanted to ask a little bit about sort of evidence in the New Testament, manuscripts, that kind of thing. Peter, for instance, asks, what's the best quick way, and I don't know if that's possible with you, Tom, but to show sceptics how reliable the Gospels are without simply saying, well, the majority of New Testament scholars say?
Yeah, it is difficult because in ancient history, we've got really very little evidence. On the other hand, we do know that Julius Caesar was murdered in 44 BC. We do know that Jerusalem was destroyed in AD 70. We do know that the Romans squashed the last great Jewish revolt in 135 AD. There are fixed points. How do we get those fixed points? We look at the historical evidence and we tell a story in which those things come together and make sense. In the same way, we look at the evidence, not only in the Gospels, but in the wider world, and we say, here is a new movement, which is significantly different from its parent Judaism. How did it start? How did it happen? Well, the Gospels tell a story that goes like this. Does that story make sense within the world of Galilee and Palestine in the first third of the first century AD? Yes, it jolly well does, and here's how. And of course, if you don't take a full high view of the Bible, then you can say, well, there may be some bits Jesus may not have said that. But that he was and did substantially what the Gospels say he was and did, I think is absolutely there. And of course, that then raises all sorts of questions. How do we fit together the Jesus of John's Gospel with the Jesus of Matthew, Mark, and Luke? That's fine. I'm up for those questions, perhaps not now, but those are important questions. But I think the key thing is this. People often, and it's a kind of a late modern thing, people often say, I want to have certainty. Please, I need to have certainty. Mm. And actually, sorry, mate, you don't need to have certainty. Okay, when you're opening a bank account, you need to have reasonable certainty that they're not going to lose your money. But you know, when you get married, when you do the really important things in life, when, as a musician, you write a new symphony or something, do you have certainty that this is beautiful? Do you have certainty that this person really loves you and will always love you? No, you don't. But these are the things that make life worth living. And so we should expect God is not a mathematical formula that you can put into a box. Yeah, 2 + 2 = 4. Got it. Good. Fine. Now what do we do? You know, God wants us to grow. And the way he makes us grow is by giving us these big questions and says, join me in the adventure of exploring them.
We'll come back to Paul in a moment, but just staying on this issue of trying to find evidence, the task of many apologists and so on, who I think have been hugely indebted to your work on the resurrection, for instance. I've heard you quoted innumerable times in apologetics talks when people bring evidence for the resurrection. They will obviously bring lots of the sort of research that you've done in that area and how it fits the Jewish context and so on. How much are we supposed to be trying to do that with the Bible? I mean, Jason Robolakis, for instance, asks, is there any evidence for miracles claimed by the New Testament other than the resurrection? For example, Jesus feeding the 5,000. Now, are we supposed to go looking for sort of telltale clues that these miracles also have some sort of evidentiary basis?
We are still, with this question, like the others, I'm sorry, we are still in the world of modernism, which is to say we are trying to live as 18th century rationalists. Please, folks, let's give that up.
But isn't that what you've done with the big book on the resurrection?
No, it precisely isn't. That is how some people use it.
Right.
The real argument of the big book on the resurrection is to say, to challenge the skeptics, to say, as we look at all the evidence that's out there, and it's a big book because there's a lot of evidence of different sorts of worldviews, et cetera, then you will see that when you ask the question, why did Christianity begin and take the shape it did, the answer the New Testament gives is Jesus of Nazareth was raised from the dead. But the skeptics have said, oh, no, we know that this really happened or that really happened or some other solution. And actually what history is very good at doing is unmasking all of those and showing that all the alternatives are wildly implausible. This doesn't prove in some mathematical sense that Jesus rose from the dead. What it does is create a context in which the challenge comes back. Are you prepared to believe that maybe there is a living creator God who actually has raised Jesus from the dead? So it isn't, you can't fit the resurrection of Jesus into the modern rationalistic worldview. It explodes that worldview and gives you a new sort of rationality, the other side of that. The illustration I've often used is very important to me. Imagine a college or a school which is given by some wealthy old member a great, wonderful work of art, which is too big and too extraordinary and powerful to put into any of the spaces they've got. And eventually they decide to pull down chunks of the college and redesign it around this thing. You've still got a college at the end. You've actually got a better college. In other words, you don't abandon reason. No. You've still got rationality at the end of it. But what you lose is the rather tight, nervous 18th century rationalism. Now, hence the point about the word miracle. Let's give up the word miracle, because the word miracle comes to us now in our culture from that Epicurean or deist world, which envisages a God who is outside the process and occasionally reaches in, does something funny, and then pushes off again. That is not what the New Testament's talking about. So when people say, can we believe in miracles? I say no, because the word miracle gives us this sense of an normally absent God sometimes reaching in. That's not the God of the Bible. What we have, and I talk about this in Simply Jesus, is the launching of space, time, and matter in a new mode. And it's not discontinuous with our present space, time, and matter, but this is God's new creation. And the thing about what we call the miracles is not, wow, there seem to be radical abnormalities within the old world. No, the point is, these are the things which are starting to be normal in the new world, which we see close up and personal with Jesus, and then which, through the ministry of the gospel thereafter, start to happen in different ways in the wider world. It's about the launching of new creation, not about an invasion into the old creation.
Let's move on. New creation. An issue that often comes up in the context of Paul is women and what he says about male-female relationships, Jews, Gentiles, slaves, free, and so on. Lucy, for instance, wanted to ask this very quick question. I'm sure you've tackled it a number of times. If I can find it. Yes, here it is. What is your reading and therefore application of a passage like 1 Timothy 2, in particular with reference to verse 11? When it comes to these issues, what's your general understanding of what Paul's getting at, what the whole thing is about?
I don't know if your listeners will have 1 Timothy 2 to hand, let alone in the Greek text. Part of the difficulty there is that Paul uses there some very unusual words, which are
Can you give us the words in English, first of all?
It depends, because this is precisely what's at issue, is the translation. And I don't have my own translation here in the studio with me, but I would say to anyone who wants to know what I really think is going on here, look at Paul for Everyone, the Pastoral Epistles, which is the little commentary that I did on the pastorals, because I actually spend longer on that passage than on most other passages there, for obvious reasons, because the way it's been translated, I think, does not do justice to the nuanced thing that Paul is saying. Paul is writing almost certainly to a situation in Ephesus where religion was basically a female thing. You have Diana or Artemis, the great goddess, who only has female priests. That's deep in the Ephesian culture, and it's very natural that therefore, if this seems to be like a new religion, this Christianity thing, that people in Ephesus might assume, well, basically, let's find the women to be the leaders. And sorry, you men, here in Ephesus, this is how we do stuff. I mean, that is actually changing culturally in Ephesus in the first century, but the basic tradition is Diana. And I think what is being said is, when Paul is talking about allowing women to study privately and with given the leisure to study, it doesn't mean they should sit down, shut up, and go and make the tea. It means they must have the leisure to be themselves students. But then he says, I'm not saying that women should take over the show, which is a cultural reference to what they might have assumed in that place, but that they have to be given space to learn, and then we will go ahead together.
So when for instance, typically in an English translation, it might say, for instance, I do not permit a woman to have authority over a man. What's going on there?
The difficulty is the word to have authority. If you look it up in a Greek lexicon, it's actually got about 15 different meanings. I did some work on this a year or two ago because I was challenged in the newspapers about this, and I had to sort of go back and check all my lexicography. But the key words there are very difficult and very slippery, and they only occur, one of the key words only occurs there in the New Testament. It's a very rare word. So, as always, when that happens, there are plenty of other places where that happens as well, we have to be rather cautious about saying what precisely is meant by it. Very interesting. Why is it in certain bits of our culture that people take that little verse from 1 Timothy 2 so seriously, and they ignore large chunks of what's going on in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John? And this is really very serious as a critique of bits of our contemporary Christian culture. Why are we so fixated and nervous about this? When I talk about this issue, I always start with John 20. This is not an accident that when Jesus is raised from the dead, the first person who is commissioned to go and tell other people that he's alive, that he's the Lord, that he's ascending to the Father, is Mary Magdalene. That you know, John does nothing by accident. Jesus did nothing by accident, for goodness sake. This and that's the beginning of the announcement of the Christian gospel, and it is given to Mary Magdalene. From that point, this is part of new creation. Everything's different now, guys. And then what Paul is doing is navigating within a very interesting bit of pagan culture how that works and doesn't work. I don't mean that the women should take over. I don't mean that the women should boss everyone else around. They must be given leisure to study. Mm. It's not an either or. We've got to do this together.
But in a sense, for millennia, the church did take a certain view on those kinds of passages, or whether it was just a cultural thing, I don't know. But you know, it is a relatively recent phenomenon that women have been ordained.
It isn't. In the New Testament, you have Junior, who is an apostle in Romans 16. I know there's been a lot of debate about that, but anyone listening who's worried about that, it is absolutely certain, exegetically, linguistically, contextually, that in Romans 16, Paul refers to Junior as an apostle. He also has entrusted Romans, the great greatest letter ever written to a lady called Phoebe, who is a deacon in the church in Cencraeae. She's an office bearer. She's on her way on a business trip to Rome. Women quite independent in that world. The idea that all women in the first century were sort of, dumbed down little housefrows is absolutely not the case. There are plenty of independent women, independent means. Phoebe, therefore, is the carrier of the letter to Rome, and that almost certainly means not only would she read it out, but if they had questions, they would ask her. It's highly likely that Phoebe was the first person in history to expound the letter to the Romans. Now, when you get that in the text, and Junia as an apostle, and the other people in Romans 16 who are clearly in ministry, some as husband-wife teams, some as independent men, some as independent women, then, I want to say, lighten up, guys. Why are we so worried about this? And it goes on. And, of course, in the ancient world, this was highly revolutionary, and it was hard to navigate. But then I want to say in 200 or 300 years from now, if such years still exist, people will look back at the early years of the 20th century and see that we are mistaken and muddled about all sorts of things that we take for granted in our culture, whether it's driving petrol-driven cars around the place. They were aware that these things were polluting the planet, that these were going to cause crises, and yet they went on doing it. And Christians went on. People will not be able to believe.
Sure. Yeah, we do tend to have our own cultural sort of like blinkers on, don't we?
Absolutely. All the time.
You're listening to Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. My special guest today is Tom Wright, or N.T. Wright, as he's also known in the academic world. He's Professor of New Testament and Early Church History at the University of St. Andrews here in the UK. And he's joining me just to finish up this conversation in a moment's time on the third part of Unbelievable. So come back for that in just a moment's time here on the programme that aims to get you thinking. Welcome back to the third and final part of Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. And if you're able to stick around this Saturday afternoon on Faith Explored, we're going to be hearing from Brother Guy Consolmagno. He joins me between 4 and 5 to talk about why he's been termed the Pope's astronomer. Yes, he works as an astronomer within the Vatican. Interesting story, has an asteroid named after him. Be asking him about that and about the way he views the whole science faith conversation. That's between 4 and 5 this Saturday afternoon. Next week on the show, well, there is no radio show of Unbelievable. That's because of our autumn fundraising appeal Together Now. That'll be taking over for the weekend. So you won't hear me then, but do join me on Sunday morning next week when I'll be presenting a couple of hours of the programming of that fundraising appeal. Look forward to having you with me for that. If, though, you're a desperate Unbelievable fan online and you just can't survive without an episode coming in via your iPod or your podcasting software, don't worry, I will be putting something up. More than likely, it's going to be a debate that was held recently in London on the issue of abortion, particularly the use of graphic abortion images outside clinics. That was a debate that was held between Anne Furedi, who's the head of the pro-abortion organisation, the British Pregnancy Advisory Service, and Greg Cunningham, who leads a pro-life movement in the US. So we're going to be seeing if we can get that online for you and in your ears at the same time next week here on Unbelievable. Right now, it's time to go back into that conversation with Tom Wright, just finishing up his thoughts on women in leadership and that kind of thing. If you can stick around, though, a little bit later on in the programme, I'm going to be speaking to Ian Morris, who's the man behind the God Question DVD series. He's going to be telling us about where that all came from and responding to how we treated the subject on the show in recent weeks.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Well, Tom, before the break, we were talking about Paul and his view of women in the New Testament. Bringing it right up to the modern day then, what Paul has to say about new creation and so on, have to play into those very real debates going on about women bishops, for instance? I mean, the synod is going to be meeting shortly discussing again that issue.
As I say, I make no bones about it. The basic foundation of all Christian ministry is the announcement that the crucified Jesus has been raised from the dead, and the first person who does that is Mary Magdalene. Yeah, I rest my case. Don't need to go any further. It's there in John 20. From there on, the idea of women in leadership ought to have been a natural. And we see it in Paul. Let's do it. Let's not. And to make the the anti-case on the basis of 1 Timothy 2. That's not, of course, how many in the Church of England make the anti-case, because many would do that in terms of tradition, in terms of where Roman Catholicism is. Mm. Though, who knows, with the present Pope, all sorts of things, might happen. Yeah. I mean, the trouble there is, as a Catholic friend of mine said, you know, one day the Pope will wake up and look at his watch and say, it's time we ordained women, and it'll just happen. And they will put out an encyclical saying, as the Church has always taught, you know, dot, dot, dot. But we, being Anglicans, we have to agonize and wrestle about it and have these horrible debates in synods and so on. And I pray for Archbishop Justin and Sentamu for their leadership in many things, and certainly in this, that we will this time be able to come around that corner and get out into the clear.
It's time to start wrapping things up, Tom. You've been so generous with your time. Let's finish again with Paul. What's your hope for this book? I mean, it's obviously aimed at a primarily academic audience. Would that be fair to say?
Yes and no. Like all the academic books I write, I've tried to write it in such a way that an, quote, ordinary reader, unquote, can get hold of it. Okay, don't worry about the footnotes, but the text itself, I think, reads in rather a fun way. I enjoyed writing it. Good. And the early feedback I've had is that, yes, this is actually quite readable, which is nice. My hope is, obviously, at the centre, that people will see Paul in the multidimensional way that he deserves to be seen, rather than just as this rather narrow figure who taught justification, who taught one or two other things, and that's it. No, he's a big character. There's much going on. Second, then, that within that, the big topics like justification, which there's a long section on justification, as you'd expect, that they will be seen as part of Paul's larger theological vision. So you don't lose anything. What you gain is, again, the multidimensionality. But then thirdly, and this is really, I find this very exciting, with Paul, and the structure of the book demonstrates this, we can see the invention of what we now call Christian theology. The Jews didn't do theology in that sense. It was just a given. Mm. The pagans sort of did theology, but it was part of physics for them. In other words, that which is. Yes. And they talked vaguely about the gods. But for Paul, what we have is a new worldview. That is to say, a new community, a new way of being human. And the only way this way of being human, this community, this church can be sustained, is by prayerful, scriptural reflection together on who God is, who his people are, what his future is for the world. Monotheism, election, eschatology. That's an activity which Paul is teaching his churches to do, called doing theology. If the church doesn't do that, it can whistle for any hope of being either united or holy or witnessing. Paul has this vision of a united, holy and witnessing church and says, for that we need Christian theology. And here it is.
Thank you so much for being with me. As I've mentioned, N.T. Wright's new book, Paul and the Faithfulness of God, available now through all good Christian bookstores and beyond, I'm sure. And I imagine for those who don't want to put their back out by lifting it up, it's also available on Kindle and so on. All this.
It's available as an ebook. Yes.
So that's all good because it's a weighty volume. But so much in there, so much more that could have been said, of course, on today's programme. But it's flown by. Tom, thank you for being with me
on
the show today.
And good wishes to all your splendid listeners.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, I'd love to hear what you thought of the way Tom responded to your questions on the programme today. Do feel free to email unbelievable@premier.org.uk. And of course, you can get in touch via the Twitter and Facebook accounts. That's @unbelievablejb for my Twitter handle, facebook.com/unbelievablejb to follow the show on Facebook. All of those links and more, links to the podcast where you can simply download the show every week automatically. That's at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. And we'll be getting to some of your responses to last week's debate on education, RE lessons in particular, and whether evangelical Christians should be playing a part in them. Very interesting responses to that. First of all, though, before we get to some of your responses, do you remember this from a month or so ago?
The God question is at the heart of an ongoing and sometimes acrimonious debate between those who see no role for God in the universe and others who view science as revealing the very handiwork of the Creator.
Religious explanations, although they may have been satisfying for many centuries, are now superseded and outdated.
I think contemporary cosmology is not merely consistent with the existence of a creator. I think it actually is supportive.
Sometimes I'm fond of calling myself a militant agnostic. I don't know, and you don't either.
Yes, we did two shows looking at the God Question DVD series. It's available from thegodquestion.tv. And for those two programmes, I was joined firstly by Lawrence Krauss, an atheist scientist, and Professor John Lennox, a Christian scientist and mathematician. And then for the second programme on consciousness, we spoke to Michael Roos, atheist philosopher, and Christian philosopher Keith Ward. So two really interesting programmes, two very different programmes, and they caused a lot of response as well from listeners. So it's been really interesting to hear your thoughts as they've continued to come in on those two questions. I thought, though, it would make sense, having profiled those particular DVD series, to talk to the creator, Ian Morris from Caris Productions. Ian, thank you for joining me today.
My pleasure, Justin.
It's great to have you on the programme. Tell me where this God Question DVD series came from to begin with.
I think they were motivated by a good old British interest in truth and fairness. You know, there is a stereotype that walks the streets as well as the minds of people in the Western world these days that God is no longer a necessary explanation for anything because science has progressively filled up all the gaps in our knowledge. You meet that idea everywhere. And this culminates in the new atheist claim, for example. Richard Dawkins is a great example of this, that claim that anyone retaining belief in God is guilty of something he calls delusion, not very flattering. And we thought the truth of that assertion needed thoroughly checked out in relation to the evidence. You see, those who assert that God is a delusion go on to castigate believers as blind intellectually and as anti-progress. But if God does exist, then that's an unfair assertion. So we were interested in pursuing truth and fairness and in checking out all the evidence that we could on both sides in an honest search for truth and fairness.
And you have done that. You've attempted to do that. You went all over the world talking to people well-known in their fields on both sides of this debate. I'm sure you must have met a lot of interesting characters and learned an awful lot along the way.
Indeed. You say they're interesting characters, and I have to say I like them. We had a wonderful time. Thoroughly educational process and very relational as well. I suppose my own personal favourite moment might have been when our good friend Peter Atkins waved his goodbye from the steps of his home. Peter's an atheist, as almost everyone will know. And his last words to her as were a cheery, God bless you, which I thought was incredibly funny.
Absolutely. Let's talk a little bit about what you thought about the two programmes we did here on Unbelievable, responding to the God Question DVD series. First of all, there was Lawrence Krauss and John Lennox talking about the cosmos and does it leave space for God? And secondly, two philosophers debating consciousness and the God Question. What were your overall reactions to both?
Well, absolute pleasure, really. I thought they were terrific programs that illustrated some very, very important things. You know, you can listen to these programs at one level as conversation and tune in and just enjoy what's going on. But I think those programs actually represented two very different aspects of the challenge of having this debate. The first one with Lawrence Krauss and John Lennox illustrated for me the difficulties that we have in this debate of getting people onto the same page so that we can even have a conversation. John and Lawrence, for example, have different views about God, the very central concept of the investigation. So when Lawrence uses the word God, he means something very different from what John Lennox means. And that creates some difficulty sometimes in fairly assessing the evidence because the criteria they're using are actually different from one another. Now, the other program illustrated a different interesting phenomenon in the debate, I think. Here we have two philosophers, not surprisingly, agreeing that life is complicated and science doesn't give us the answers to everything. And therefore, there's really something to investigate here in terms of the big question, why are we here? So they're both agreed about a lot of the basic ideas that fuel this debate. And yet, when it comes to the bottom line, one says, I can see plenty of evidence of God, and the other says, I see insufficient evidence of God. And one wonders, why do two people who agree about so much then diverge so strongly on the bottom line? And that's not so much a challenge in holding the debate, so much as a very interesting observation.
Going back to the Krauss debate with Lennox, one of the things Lawrence Krauss said was, God isn't important enough to spend any time worrying about, but yeah, the real universe is. What do you make of those kinds of sentiments?
Well, Justin, those kind of sentiments worry me greatly. We set out on what I described as an honest search for truth. And when people make assertions, that's the key word here, make assertions of that kind right at the start, then that starts being an obstacle in the search for truth. And I think as a referee, in many ways, you in your role and I in mine as producer, we're like referees. And I think we're perfectly in order to say, wait a minute, those kind of comments really break the rules because we're starting off dismissing the very thing that we are here to discuss. And that dismissal doesn't come accompanied by any kind of rational argument. It's a statement that we're asked to accept. And I think the warning lights ought to flash in everyone's mind when they encounter statements like that. It comes with sometimes with great authority, but that is a mask because the authority isn't there when you have no argument for the point that you're trying to make.
Here's another quote from Lawrence Krauss in that discussion, Ian. He said, there is no why question in general. The why question is an invention. It presumes there must be purpose. It presumes the answer before it asks the question. What was your response to when he said that?
Justin, it really was a surprise because I think that what Lawrence is doing here is trying to eliminate philosophy from the whole debate. And when someone says to me, there are no why questions, my reaction to that is to ask, why not? So immediately we've illustrated that you cannot eliminate the why questions at all. Not least of all because by attempting to eliminate the why question, you assume the universe has no purpose. And why should someone do that? There's that question again. Much better, I think, to ask how you would make an assessment of whether or not the universe has purpose. And to be fair, I think eventually Lawrence did come around to agreeing that we would be permitted to ask if there is purpose. But he comes to the question with a presupposition that there is no purpose. Now, how can you search for truth when you begin with large presuppositions like that?
Then, of course, there was the Michael Roos and Keith Ward debate on consciousness and God. What were some of the takeaway points for you in that particular debate?
I think the most important thing about that debate, there were many very interesting points of discussion. I mean, they talked about the nature of reality, hugely interesting. They talked about near-death experience, similarities and differences in religions, and what does that actually tell us? But for me, the most significant thing was, in fact, the conclusion. In addressing the God question, each one of us has a judgment to make about which side has the more convincing argument. And that's where Michael and Keith diverge. Now, as a philosopher, Keith Ward has carefully analysed this issue, in this case consciousness, and concluded that there is an intelligence above all, and that's a better explanation for the mysteries and complexities and the wonders of consciousness than just saying nature did it. And the other argument represented by Michael is that consciousness, yes, I agree, is a deep mystery, but somewhere there must be a natural explanation, even though Michael doesn't know what that explanation would look like, and he makes that point very interestingly. And I think as listeners, we must judge whether Keith Ward's view really does shed sensible light on the mystery, or whether Michael Roos, on the other hand, is credible in not offering any light at all, if you see what I mean. He describes himself as a skeptic. He describes himself as not knowing. But on the other hand, he rejects God as an unconvincing explanation. But that leaves Michael in the dark about what other conceivable explanation there could be.
It was a pleasure to be able to set those up and to reflect on the God Question DVD series. How are you hearing about how it's being used? It's obviously aired in a number of countries on some TV stations. It's also being picked up as a DVD around the world as well. What stories are coming back?
Well, the stories that are coming back is that people are very excited by this resource, and of course that's very fulfilling for us to hear. I just over the weekend, for example, there were three simple examples of just the diverse way in which the series is being used. One of them, perhaps a less usual one, of course, is that the series was actually being offered as a reward to people who had been involved in a competition, an arts competition about the natural world. And I suppose it was delightful to think that the organisers of that nationwide competition thought that the God question investigated the natural world so thoroughly that it was a fitting prize for the winners of that competition to receive. That was one. And then it was the God question was presented at a national conference on Saturday, where the theme was Speak Out, Make a Difference, where people are wrestling with the big questions of life and what to say about them and how to attempt to impact other people's lives. In the evening of the same day, in Norway, one of the programs was being screened at a large conference to an audience of several hundred young people. One very interesting fact is that the Exploring the God Question series is being picked up by teachers. It appears that the agenda we set for the program, for the series, overlaps quite significantly with the curriculum in senior school, even to the point where we have been asked to participate in a national conference for teachers, and the title is Exploring the God Question in the Curriculum. And it's a national conference for teachers of RE, philosophy, and science. We find that fascinating. And the stories that are coming back is that people are really gripped by this, and I think that the reason is that, like your program, Justin, I have to say, we're bedfellows in that respect. We're bringing people from both sides really to grapple with the issues in an honest search for truth. It's a kind of East meets West approach that people are really appreciating. We're also aware that the programs are having impact on people's thinking. We're getting lots of feedback, lots of questions. People are engaged, and that's what it's about, engaging people with the big issues.
Well, thank you very much for joining me on the programme today. And if you want to have more information, find out how you could get hold of a copy of the God Question DVD series, do go to the website. It's thegodquestion.tv. Okay, well, let's go to some of your responses to last week's debate. Christian David Robertson took on Terry Sanderson of the National Secular Society. They were debating the appropriate place of evangelical Christians in RE lessons after a condemning report by the National Secular Society about the fact that they believe that Christians are using it for evangelistic purposes. A lot of your responses to this. Sorry, I don't have as much time as usual to get to some of them. First of all, this one came in by text, said, I'm from a Sikh background. I found RE boring as it wasn't applicable to real life. When someone comes into a class and gives evidence of how their life has improved with the help of God, well, that gives hope to sad lives. And why deny a child of this truth? At seven, I wanted to know the truth and make an informed choice. A child doesn't like to be lied to. No parent would object to their child learning the truth. Why stop children from learning the truth? Well, I suppose that all depends on whether you believe what's being told to them is the truth or not, I suppose, and that was kind of what was at stake last week. Darren is not a Christian, but says he was dismayed at last week's discussion between Terry Sanderson and David Robertson. The Secular Society's report was very light on evidence. However, neither guest mentioned a follow-up report is being undertaken, which will give more concrete evidence. Surely that impacts the discussion heavily. The Secular Society want to put the issue out there, and I think a report with less anecdotal evidence will be helpful. I do, however, think it's the height of hypocrisy for David to mock the report as anecdotal when he was saying he'd be willing to tell children that he's experienced healing through prayer. You cannot get more anecdotal than that. Is it anecdotal, Darren, if it's the person who actually experienced the healing telling it? That sort of first-hand experience, surely, at some level. But appreciate your point. You say you teach RE in a Church of England school, and the department consists of religious and non-religious teachers. The quality is very high. We never stray beyond a this-is-what-Christians-believe style of teaching. The pupils are more than capable of deciding the merits, if the evidence or lack thereof, of what they believe. Incidentally, I don't lead assemblies, as I can't in all good conscience end with a prayer, not being religious myself. This is the type of environment best for discussion, where we have a choice and views are not imposed explicitly. This is best for pupils from every background. Meanwhile, Nick says, thanks for the great show. I had cheered some to myself last week when I heard David Robertson will be on, and as always, he delivered, especially against Terry, who wants to think that he and his fellow secularists alone are neutral. The idea that go in and teach that all opinions on such matters are equal would not be neutral anyway. David's entirely right in that the question of what if it's true doesn't seem to matter. It's what fits the agenda. And naturally, I've been ecstatic knowing N.T. Wright will be in the studio again. His book's definitely on top of my Christmas wish list. Tom in Charlotte, North Carolina says, I just finished listening to the podcast on RE. David Robertson did an excellent job of exposing what unreasonable dogmatic ideology can do to an intelligent person. He, as in David, failed to see the neutral stance of the National Secular Society regarding religious proselytising in public schools and unjustly called it promotion of another philosophy. Terry Sanderson clearly and respectfully explained the legitimate concerns of not only non-Christians, but Christians who do understand and respect the concept of separation of church and state. Here's another one from Matt, who said last Saturday's show, although I found the demeanour of both participants made the show less enjoyable to listen to than, say, Keith Ward and Michael Roos a few weeks ago, the gold standard in my book for the way two opposing parties should interact, I felt that many of the points Terry put forward were legitimate, and I too found David heading off into the stratosphere on occasion. However, I found Terry's inconsistency on some things inexcusable. For example, he argues that parents should reserve the right to bring up their child and encourage them to follow a certain religion or view, and hence there should be stricter controls of religion being taught in schools. He then goes on to talk about the child being able to make up their own mind, objectively, without the influence of church groups through RE lessons. Am I missing something? It seems as though school RE lessons, excluding peer pressure, are near always going to be more objective than a parent actively encouraging their child to believe a certain way. Terry also insists on referring to faith schools. However, it seems to me as though parents should not be at all surprised if they send their child to a C of E school, say, and he or she comes home with a Bible. Thanks, Justin, chairing this fierce debate on an incredibly pertinent topic. Our time is up, so it's just time for me to tell you what's coming up next week.
You're unbelievable.
Well, if you're listening on Saturday next week, you won't actually be hearing me. You'll be hearing our special autumn fundraising appeal Together Now. In fact, the whole of the coming week is being given over to that. It's a special week every autumn that we hold. So if you're looking for Unbelievable, I'll be back the following week, and I'm sure I'll have another interesting program ready for you. I am going to put something online, though. If you follow Unbelievable via the podcast, we'll make sure to put up a debate. Hoping to put up Anne Furedi, who's a pro-abortion activist, with Greg Cunningham, a leader of a pro-life organisation in the US, and they're debating the graphic use of abortion images outside abortion clinics. That was from a debate they had, a public debate in London recently. So check back on the website for that if you want to find out more. premier.org.uk/unbelievable. In the meantime, thank you for being with me today. And if you're able to stay here on Premier Radio, you're going to be hearing me in conversation with Brother Guy Consolmagno, the Pope's astronomer. But if you're leaving us now, thank you for listening. See you next time.